We sometimes mistake the eye of the beholder for what the beholder sees. When that happens, our guest on this edition of Conversation says it's time to look carefully at the beholder's eye. I'm Susan McGinnis. On this edition of Conversations, we'll talk with Professor Ralph Maud. We'll take a look at stories and storytellers, ethnographers and mythographers. Stay with us. Dr. Maud, thanks very much for joining us. When we talked before the show, I asked you if you'd be willing to tell and read as many stories as possible during the course of this hour so we can kind of introduce people to the British Columbian and Yukon Indian myths you've studied for 30 years or so. Can we start with a story?
Well, I did do this book, The Porcupine Hunter and Other Stories, by Henry Tate. Now, Henry Tate was a Port Simpson Tsimshian Indian, died in 1913, wrote these stories, didn't tell them. He wrote them to Franz Boas in New York because Boas asked him to.
Boas the anthropologist.
Boas the father of modern American anthropology, or American anthropology. Yeah. And I've published this book because I'm so mad at Boas for the way he put these stories down on paper. Because he took Henry Tate's English. The funny thing is that Henry Tate actually wrote these. I've seen the manuscripts, studied them. He wrote the stories in English and did a Tsimshian line underneath. Not the way you're supposed to do it. Boas wrote to him and said, "Don't do that. I want the Tsimshian first, and then you can do any kind of a literal English translation of the Tsimshian interlinearly." That's what they talk about, interlinear translations. Mm-hmm. Tate, Boas asked him twice, but Tate kept doing the wrong thing. Now, for Boas, it was the wrong thing.
Right.
Not for me, because I don't know Tsimshian, but I know English. So I was able to say, Tate is my man. Tate is a writer in English. In fact, I often talk about him as the first creative writer in British Columbia, long before like George Woodcock or any of the ones that we talk about. So I give him that primacy. But if I'm going to give him that primacy, I have to take his English as being creative writing the way he wanted to do it, and of course it's a little bit pidgin English. Now, when Boas did this, he made it into a kind of a formal standard English with a little Germanic. I mean, he was from Germany; English was his second language, so he obviously was making it rather stiff, making it very formal. So that when you go to the shelves in the library and pull down these volumes of mythology that he published, and now don't get me wrong, I mean, it is absolutely marvelous that we have those. And I mean, if he hadn't done that, I wouldn't be able to complain about him, right? So, but I don't know anybody who actually goes to the shelves and pulls down any of those volumes with an anticipation of pleasure. Because mm-hmm. when you open them up, there's page after page of Boasian English, not Tate English.
The eye of the beholder.
So if I read a bit of this, you'll see that it's very strange. He calls it the history of the porcupine. I pick up on this one. It's very interesting to compare some of these phrases with what Boas does with them. And I think this is very much more vivid than Boas. It's the story of the grizzly bear trying to settle in for the winter, but it's raining and he really wants frost. So who brings frost? Well, the porcupine brings frost. So he grabs a porcupine. This is. Shall I just give you a little of Henry Tate, 1910, let's say, 1910. Henry Tate sitting in his shack in Port Simpson, surrounded by people who were speaking Tsimshian, and presumably was told this as a child. I don't know, but anyway, he's retelling it in English so that I, as a monoglot English speaker, can pass it on with authority. I couldn't if it was in the Tsimshian. While the time in the fall, when all the animals went into their dens, also the great grizzly bear sat in his own den for winter sleep. And the great rain descended, and therefore the drops of water in the great grizzly bear's den, and his fur is full of water, and he was disappointed as long as the rain. So he sat at the door of his den, looking out for something. Now I put it on the page with almost like poetry. See, the lines, the definition of prose is that the lines go to the right-hand margin, and the definition of poetry is that they don't. So we, so this has got to be poetry, except it isn't, it's cut up prose. But at the same time, well, you know, Del Himes would be mad at me for doing it this way, because he believes that it is, all this stuff is poetry. Mm-hmm. And if he was here, he'd be saying, you know, Del Himes is the master in this field. I mean, he's way up there. And of course he knows the languages, and he looks for initial markers, repetitions which indicate where a line would begin because of little clues that are, we look for rhymes at the end of lines, we look for rhythms, iambic pentameter. When you've got five pentameters, you know you've come to the end of the line and you begin again, and there's rhymes and so on. We have our own way of indicating where, how poetry is going to work. Dalheim says that these native texts indicate the new lines by the beginnings of the lines, by little, like they say, now then, or now, or mm-hmm. thus, or therefore, and that these things turn it into verse from prose. In order to do that, you've got to really know the language, and you've got to really work hard, and you've got to be Del Himes. Now, there is nobody like Del Himes, so I don't know what's going to happen to that. The reason I've put it into so-called verse or pretended verse is really to get white space, because white space means that it isn't continuous. I think there was a lot of pauses in this. Mm-hmm. I think there were maybe pauses in this, as long as the pause that I've just given you. I mean, we nice. Pause, yes. Let it sink in. The grizzly's in his den. What's going to happen? He's looking for something. Mm-hmm. That's what it says. He's looking for porcupine. But all right, I'll just go on. And while he was there, behold, a porcupine coming along. As she passed the door of great grizzly bear den, that grizzly bear said, will you come in here, friend? I will sup with you. Therefore the porcupine turned in the great grizzly bear's den. Then the grizzly bear make a large fire. Then he caught the poor porcupine and bind her foot and hands and put her near the fire and burned her back fur with fire. Then the great grizzly bear said to porcupine while he was burnt her back fur, make frost, you little unsightly animal. Do, 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 says the great grizzly bear. Yes. No, he knows that the porcupine is the animal that can make frost, so he orders the porcupine to do it. And I don't know what do 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 means, but that's in the English as well as in the Tsimshian. It's a charm, or maybe it's just the usual way they bully. Mm-hmm.
Do it now.
Yeah.
They say so.
Well, it's like the English do.
Yeah.
And in fact, yes, I will do, said the porcupine. I mean, maybe the porcupine is. Maybe Henry Tate is having the porcupine say, I will do. That's what the club and the Boy Scouts, the Cub Scouts say, isn't it? Dib, dib, dib. We'll dob, dob, dob. I don't know. You weren't in the Boy Scouts.
No. I missed that one.
Master, loose my binds, then I will do what you want. But the great grizzly bear won't hear her, what the poor porcupine said to him. Because he was great and strong, he has power over all animals, so he did not hear what poor animal, that is the porcupine, have said to him. The proud heart was against her. Then he kicked her into the fire once more. Make frost, you little ugly porcupine, do, 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 said the great grizzly bear. He mocked the poor porcupine. Then the back fur of porcupine burnt. So, in italics, so all the porcupine back, not much fur now, apparently. That's one thing, if I'm going to be a real ethnologist and storyteller, I've got to see a porcupine. Mm. I don't think I've ever seen... Have you seen a porcupine? Yes, in a zoo or in reality? Have you noticed it doesn't have much fur on the back? Really? Well, this story must be true. It has plenty of spikes at the rear end, but on the back it's kind of thin out, thin?
They say, yes, thin.
This is one of the, this then falls into the category of etiological. They have a big word for it. It means just so, telling, like Rudyard Kipling's just so stories. Mm-hmm. That's how it came to be. That's how an elephant got its trunk. Just so. Well, this is how the porcupine got not much fur on its back, because the grizzly bear threw it into the fire. Three times. Things come in threes in this culture as well as in ours. Mm. We have three bears, we have three little pigs. You can tell a culture by what things come in, threes or fours or fives. And and that's what Del Himes says about the verse. It will come in groups of threes or fours or fives according to what's in the mind of the narrator.
Do you know why that is? Three bears, three acts in a play.
Well, don't you know? It's genetic.
But it is.
They're
a
finding,
rhythm we're
they're
comfortable
finding,
with.
They're finding genetic reasons for everything. If you're shy, you have genes for shyness. A professor at Harvard, I know, who has spent 13 years with little newborns and one-year-olds, and you know, some of them hide behind their mother's skirts, and the others come out and shake your hand. And there's it isn't culture that's done that. It's genes. Where are the genes? So I think it is. There are some basic differences that are inherited, I think. Mm-hmm. Now, when this poor weak animal, almost dead, for she scorched her skin, she said to Great Grizzly Bear, "Have mercy on me, sir. I will do for what you wanted." Then again, the grizzly bear kicked again. This grizzly bear doesn't seem to know when he's getting his own way. I think bullies must be kind of. I mean. Bullies like to bully, they don't like to stop, so if they get their own way, then that's not what they really want. The grizzly bear says the same words, "Make a frost, you little unsightly animal." The great grizzly bear done it many times. And when the poor thing was dying, he threw her outside his den. There she laid a long while. Pause. And when she opened her eyes and tried to walk away with pain all over her body, she began to say, "You big, ugly, great power grizzly bear, don't say anything if you've frozen to dead in your den."
Comeuppance.
I wish I could remember exactly how Boaz puts this into his piece, but it's something. In my opinion, you will have no grounds for complaint if the frost comes to you tomorrow. Really quite innocuous, but this is great stuff. "You big, ugly, great power grizzly bear, don't say anything if you've frozen to dead in your den." then...
You know, when a porcupine walks, she walks with a rolling, almost arthritic gait.
Oh, she's been in the fire.
She's been in the fire, yeah. Another explanation, just so.
Well, we don't get that in here, but see, you will be able to tell this story and add that.
Yeah.
I believe that's the way these stories uh-huh. got transmitted. You add what strikes you. And this is one of the things that gets me about Boaz. He wants all these stories to be just the way the tribe tells them. I mean, to him these are Shimshon stories. To me, they're Henry Tate stories. And when Henry Tate does it this way, he's not doing it because the tribe is speaking through him as a mouthpiece. You know, Boaz, we were talking about this, Boaz had to have this axiomatic notion that any primitive person couldn't think for themselves, really. They only could mouth what they'd learned culturally through tribal experience.
This is this notion that the ethnic, the different person from whoever you are, from Franz Boas in this case, or from ethnographers and anthropologists, is truly different than you, a breed apart.
Yes, it is, but it's also that it's not different as you as a member of a tribe. Mm-hmm. It's you as an individual. I think Boas, of course, was well aware of ethnic differences, but he tried to minimize and not even think of the fact that the people he was talking to could have individual points of view and individual stories. Why? Because he wanted this to be data for theories about transmission of, like, the Shimshon mythology coming down from the interior to the coast, or some other kind of theories about mythemes floating around, or any kind of theory about cultural matters. So he needed data, and if you just have an individual writing a story, that's not real data. But if you have it part of a tribal cultural inheritance, then you've got some data that you can work with. So he minimized.
We should give some credit to Franz Boas for a number of positive things he did. Should we not? Before we
can. Well, you can.
Okay. Well, these are my understandings. That he stopped and said that there are that not all native people, not all other people, are the same and lesser than whites. That all peoples have the dignity of their culture, their religion, beliefs, traditions, and the like, and said that we must bring some logic to the study of other peoples, yes? So he introduced a scientific method, of which you're critical, and said cultural pluralism is something that is that is a reality, and that was a change from the way people had viewed others before. Yes, I'm asking you?
Something like that.
Okay.
I mean, he stands for the notion of equality between cultures, that no culture is better, that it's cultural relativism, that every culture has its values, and we have to respect them. He found no evidence for inferiority, measured a lot of skulls in his time,
yeah.
Found that skull shapes were... There were various skull shapes in every culture, with every race, and that the skull shape did not determine intelligence, and so on. He didn't find any evidence for inequality. I do believe that he felt superior uh-huh. himself, mm-hmm. that his own wife and family were very precious to him, and that he couldn't really believe that other people had it as good. That's what I believe.
Okay.
Because that's entering.
And At the very beginning of the program, I said that it's your belief that we have to look closely at the eye of the beholder in order to understand what the beholder says. Is that a fair thing to say? That you ask us to look closely at the mental set, the mind out of which Boaz was looking at the world?
I don't remember saying that.
Well, I don't know that you did. I mean, I...
You're paraphrasing.
I am.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how accurate that is. Fair?
I don't understand it.
We're talking on this edition of Conversations with Dr. Ralph Maud. He's been studying since about 1970, if I add up the years right, the myths and stories of Indians living in British Columbia and the Yukon Territory. He has been an English professor at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia since 1965 and recently retired from that faculty. He's also an expert in the poetry of Dylan Thomas and the poetry of Charles Olson. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations, but we're talking today about myths and storytellers. Okay, go back to Boaz for us. And it's important, I think, that we take a look at his shortcomings from your point of view and what he missed in what Henry Tate was doing, for example.
Yes, well, I sort of feel as though I've sort of caught him doing something not quite right, because he got these Tsimshian stories from British Columbia, and they were written in English, basically with a Tsimshian translation. That caused a problem for him. So what in order to publish them as authentic Tsimshian stories, he had a problem, because they weren't presented to him like that. So one of the things he did, he got, this is very interesting, I mean, a man has a problem, so what's he going to do? He found out there was a Tsimshian speaker down in Pennsylvania at the Carlisle Indian School, and he got him up to New York for a month, and he read Henry Tate's Tsimshian lines so that it was as though Archie Dundas was telling the story for himself in the field, and Franz Boas was taking it down afresh. Now Boas was wonderful with phonetic dictation. He could take down very precisely what people were saying, and marvelous talent. And if he hadn't done that, we wouldn't have anything to work on. Okay, mm-hmm. We've established that. But in order to try and get a primacy for the Tsimshian text, he used another native speaker, and that caused problems, such as for instance, in what he published with Archie Dundas doing this, Porcupine in this story is a he. Now we know, we've just read, for Tate it's a she, and I think that makes a difference. I mean, it makes a difference to the feel of the thing. Porcupine here is a she, but when he goes through Archie Dundas, now presumably in the Tsimshian, the pronouns can be either he or she, but Boaz chose to use the he, probably always did, rather than the she, and didn't look at Henry Tate's English to find out what Henry Tate thought. So we get in the volume we pull down from the shelf, you open it up, and the porcupine is a he. In Tate's mind, it was a she. Now, I think that's a violation. If Boaz was here, I'd ask him, why didn't you check with the Tate's English and see that it was a she and put the she in?
Part of the problem is he's not seeing this as literature, from your point of view, yes? And it would make a difference. I mean, if we changed a line of Dylan Thomas or Homer to suit...
All right, he's not respecting Tate's literary ability. He doesn't believe in it, mm-hmm. And he doesn't... And he wants it to be impersonal. He doesn't want any personal idiosyncrasies to operate in this, because He just wants it easy for people who are studying myth themes and the comparative mythology to be able to pick out things like the youngest, smartest myth theme. You often get, if things go in threes, the third person, the youngest, will often be the smartest. Well, you don't want to, you want to be able to pick that out easily. You don't want to be confused by any fancy tale telling or any tale telling that demands you attend to the narrator, attend to Tate as a person. Boaz didn't ask Tate for any particulars of his own life. Didn't want to know, and it didn't ask anybody. I often think of Boaz taking the train up to the northern BC, and when the train stops for water, he gets out and grabs an Indian and takes down something, and then gets back on the train. He feels as though that's going to be all right, because that person that he's just talked to is just a representative of the tribe.
That's an Indian, and that's a story.
For me, after my experience with Tate, I would say that that is disrespectful. Mm-hmm. But it was presumably what people did at the time. I want to finish the story. I'm in a state of suspension here. In order to get revenge, or in order to get her own back, the porcupine has to do magic. If we finish the story as far as we've got, there would be a certain satisfaction for us in the sense that we know what's going to happen. The grizzly bear's going to die in the den, but. For the teller of this story and for the audience, I think the most important part is what we're coming to, which is the song. The songs are always the oldest part of these stories.
I hate to do this, but I have to do this one thing at this one moment, and I know this is cruel. This is Conversations. On this edition, we're listening to stories and interpretation of them by Dr. Ralph Maud of Simon Fraser University. I'm Susan McGinnis. Please, now, go on.
Oh. Well, this is where you wish you knew the Shimshin, because these would be old words. These would be things coming in from. These would be the things that don't change between stories. They're often nonsensical in the sense that they don't have to make sense. The chance, the meaning is in the rhythms, in the ancient overlay of the words. I don't know. We have skipping songs or something where it doesn't make sense, but it communicates. For this, read like Ginger Rogers, Fred Astaire. Ginger Rogers, Fred Astaire. It's a kind of evocative of rhythm and.
Jumping rope, when you said skipping songs, that's jumping the first rope. Time I've really made that connection.
And anyway, what this says in Tate's English is, as I was walk at the foot of a beautiful green-leaved mountain, then all the stars of heaven are glittering as the skies all clear for north wind. Well, that does make sense, because what's going to happen is that it's going to be frost. Yeah. So you've got, in order to get frost, you've got to get rid of the clouds. This is the opposite of the rain dance. You've got to get rid of the clouds. You've got to get a clear sky so the north wind can come. So you're asking for a glittering sky, the north wind to come. And you repeat this over and over. She repeated this four times. I was wrong. See, this is a four mm-hmm. culture, not a three culture. But Tate only has her in the fire three times. She repeated this four times with crying, with moaning, at the end of four times. Then the north wind began to blow, and all the stars of the sky with twinkles as the north wind signs to blow hard, gives signs of blowing hard. Then the north wind blew hard, and it became very cold, and everything was frozen. Now the great grizzly bear was also frozen to dead in his den, for he was mock with weak and smaller than himself. You see, for he was mock, that means he was mocking. Tate doesn't have it quite right, and I just wondered, I don't have any reviews on this book yet, but I just wonder what some people might be saying, that it's unfair to have Indians speaking in imperfect grammatical English.
Except for that, that's the way Henry Tate spoke.
Well, that's the way he wrote these down, so we don't have to, I mean, it's... But we don't have to show him doing that. People will say, Boaz at least gave him the appearance of being somebody who was sensible. You see, I mean, the theory is that if the natives do not, they speak their own language perfectly well, when we put it into English, it should be just as perfect, because otherwise it gives the wrong impression.
Yes, but Henry Tate put it into English.
Well,
and it was Henry Tate's English.
This is a Henry Tate's English, and if you were to change it, you would be. I think you would be spoiling it. But I'm interested. I'd be interested in what the reviews say, because they may say that I shouldn't have done it.
People can't tell from the look on your face because they can't see it, but you think you should have done it.
Right.
Yes. Just so folks know, because you may be wondering now about how you could find this book, it's called The Porcupine Hunter and Other Stories by Henry Tate, edited by Ralph Maud, published by Talon Books, T-A-L-O-N, Talon Books, in 1993. You can also look for A Guide to British Columbian Indian Myth and Legend, a 1982 book from Talon Books. And in that book, Dr. Maud takes a look at the ethnographers, the people who brought the stories out from the worlds of British Columbian and Yukon Native people to the world of scholarship, and takes a look at what some of their biases and beliefs were, Boaz included, also Catholic missionaries and Anglican missionaries and others. Do you include Henry Tate in that bunch? Is he in
there? Well, he's certainly in here, yeah, but I put him in at a time when I didn't know as much about him as I do now, so that this needs to be updated. It was 82. That's I guess it's been around. Yeah.
There are other books we'll talk about as we move along, or I'll introduce you to as we go along. We're talking with Dr. Ralph Maud on Conversations. Where shall we go now? There are all sorts of options. One is to take a look at oral literature as literature, which will be a new idea to some folks who are listening. It wouldn't have been an idea that Franz Boas would have considered. It was an idea that Catherine McClellan, a more recent producer of thoughts on oral literature, would consider.
Well, Catherine McClellan, who still teaches at the University of Wisconsin, and Richard Dauenhauer, who's really a super ethnologist, that did a dissertation under her. She's responsible for many marvelous things. And I give her a lot of credit for one thing which she did, which she used the word masterpiece in relation to myth, Indian myth. And I think that was the first time anybody had done that. And she was referring to one particular myth, which was the girl who married the bear, very common, and it wasn't exactly one telling of this that she was referring to. She was referring to the fact that it exists as a something that any storyteller can draw upon as a archetypal power source, and the different tellings constitute in mass, they constitute a masterpiece. That's the word she used, and I think it's wonderful she did that.
The story itself, in its many tellings, becomes an archetypal power source. Can you define that in that context?
I don't know about that. I'm just being very vague about that. I don't know.
Okay, but the story has power in its multiple tellings, yes?
Well, any one telling may be imperfect, but it draws upon something that seems to, like it's platonic. The perfect thing is up there, waiting to be used as an ideal, and seems to have a kind of power which any particular doesn't have. This would be a platonic notion.
I see. In one of your books, you described the impact of the many storytellers as being like potters throwing pots, that all these versions come out of a similar intent.
Where do people get stories from? I think it's like language. If you don't get them from your mother's knee, it's not the same. So I think in that sense you are a product of your society. But there is artistic talent, and I think the individual potter is going to throw a pot that's going to be, I think. How are we going to judge value? I believe this is a study in its infancy, because we've got to create literary criteria, we've got to create terminology for saying what's good and what's bad and why it's good and why it's bad, and I don't think we've got them yet. I think that the reason we stumble in this area is because it's really quite new. There's a lot of people doing it now, and quite a few people in Fairbanks are doing it, and of course the Alaskan Native Language Center has provided a center for this kind of study. We've got to keep on doing it, because I think at the end of the line there's going to be a world literature here. At the moment it doesn't seem like it, partly because of the way in which these things have been printed up by the Bureau of American Ethnology, the Smithsonian series, the Columbia University series. They've been printed up in such a way that they don't look like a living literature. They look like some dead fish or something.
Who called him a corpse on the page?
Oh, who did?
Who did? Archie Finney. You wrote about that, yeah.
Now, Archie Finney, of course, that's a tragedy, a small tragedy. I mean, look at the possibilities there. He was an extremely intelligent Nez Perce Indian who got an education and had the good sense to go to Columbia, studied with Boaz. Boaz said, well, where are you going to do your field work? Well, the answer was very obvious. Go back to his home reservation, and who would be his informant? Well, his mother would be his informant. Now, you can't do better than that.
It's at mother's knee. Yeah.
Again.
Where the story comes
exactly.
From.
Exactly. Yeah. So he praises his informant in his publication. I mean, he's trying to make it into almost a scientific thing. He realizes that he's losing a lot by putting it into print. He bemoans that, but he doesn't, although he's gone a great deal of the way towards it, he just cannot find the means to make the stories live on the page and satisfy the academic notions that were pertaining at the time. So I think, as Boaz stimulated Archie Finney to do this, he also put a restraint on him to the final product should be available for science in the way that Boaz thought they should be. So Archie Finney was, that's why I call it a tragedy, because I think if he'd somehow had his way, or there'd been others doing it, or if he hadn't been born too soon, he would be one of the people that would be really pushing this forward. And in order to, how are you going to put it on the page? Well, you're going to have to use maybe, I don't know, capital letters for loudness and small letters for smallness. You can intersperse it with parentheses which say how people are looking and how the audience is reacting. And you can try and create the performance on paper. The performance is what makes it alive. The corpse is when it's there just for scholars to study. Television, of course, is the one way in which you can preserve these, but the television came in at a time when the old timers were going out, so if there are television records of old really great storytellers, well, I haven't seen them, and the chance is more or less gone for that.
How close is it to too late to capture what you're thinking of as a world literature?
Well, it isn't too late because the texts are there, and the accuracy with which Boaz put them down, and others. He taught a lot of people to do the same. Mm-hmm. I mean, Swanton and Melville Jacobs are two people that come to mind, and who in turn taught people like Del Himes and Wayne Suttles. And so you do have a lot of texts, even if you don't have them in the way you wish you could have them. But what it means is that young people coming along, and I would mention Judith Berman of Philadelphia, who studied under Del Himes, who was just beginning to examine Boaz's native language stories in detail. People like Judith are going to produce what we want from these stories because it's there in the stories.
She'll be able to find the and I'm thinking of my ears when I'm saying this, but she'll be able to find the performance on the page.
I think so. That is, she's done it for one very short piece that I was trying to work on myself. So I know what it is that she's done. With the knowledge of Kwakwala, she has been able to see the double meanings, the puns, the sexual innuendos. She's been able to get into the mind of the narrator because of the language which has been preserved. So all is not lost.
Good news. We have, tragically, about 15 minutes left, and I wonder if you would read and then tell us a little bit of the story that Catherine McClellan calls a masterpiece. Let me, while you're looking at this, tell folks a little more about Dr. Ralph Maud, our guest today on Conversations. He was educated at Harvard in the mid to late 50s, earned his PhD from Harvard University. He was a teaching assistant while at Harvard. He spent after that the years 1958 to 65 at State University of New York, the SUNY system at Buffalo, and then went to Simon Fraser University, where he has been a professor of English since 1965. He makes his home in Vancouver. He has studied and taught Indian oral literature for several years and taught in the English department at Simon Fraser, as well as at the Dylan Thomas School in Wales. He's written extensively on Dylan Thomas. He has a, is your book on Charles Olson out yet? It's on
no,
its way?
They've told me they're going to do it, but okay. That was back in May, and I haven't heard from them since.
And you never know. Charles Olson's Reading, a Biography, will be the name of that book on the man who coined the phrase, postmodernism. I want to make one more mention of books before we ask you to read and tell the story of the girl who married the grizzly bear. You may well be interested in The Salish People, the local contribution of Charles Hill II. That's a Talon book, 1978, is a four-volume set and is thought to be kind of the word in study of the Salish people. Once again, a guide to BC Indian myth and legend and the Porcupine Hunter and other stories. And now from the Porcupine Hunter and other stories.
Well, I'm gonna say that since we have this time limit, so that I'll do a shorter one because it really is. And this I think is what I would call a masterpiece. And she's already done that, so it's on record. So I'll make a claim for this one as a masterpiece of creative writing. As I say, Henry Tate, I think, he was paid by the page, 15 cents a page. And Boas reckoned that if he did 5 pages an hour, he'd get 75 cents an hour, and that seemed to be good pay. But what it meant is that he had to write. He couldn't, in order to earn this money, he couldn't spend a lot of time collecting. And I believe that he did a lot of this from memory, and he embellished. And we can seriously count him as a creative writer. And one way we can get at this is by the fact that Boas actually sent him something that Boas had previously done, Nass River Stories, printed up in 1902. He'd sent it out to Henry Tate and said, this is the kind of thing I want you to do. Well, Tate did use that as a foundation for his stories. You might even call it a sort of plagiarism, but the oral tradition is the oral tradition. You take from the past and you bring it forward. I wouldn't say that plagiarism had that kind of blame attached to it within the oral tradition, and I don't think Tate thought he was doing anything bad, but it helps us to see where he is relying on tradition and where he is actually being creative. So in this story called Sucking Intestines, that's the name of the hero, and it comes from the fact that he was born when his mother was thrown down from a coffin where she was hiding, pretending to be dead. And this is the it's a rather salacious story, and it's marvelous that it didn't get censored. There was a great town in Metlakatla, the village of Gishbakhlush, called Red Bear Village, in which a great chief and chieftainess and also the chief's nephew were living. The young man fell in lover to the chieftainess, which she loved him most, but the chief did not know it. The young man often went into her and lied down with her while the chief was away, and she became to be pregnant. Then the chieftainess resolved, "I will pretend to die on your behalf." So they all agreed. This was in order so that they could meet securely. She would pretend to be dead, and I'll let the story tell. So on the next day, the chieftainess pretended to be very sick, because she loved the young man better than her husband, and she wanted to marry that young man. Not many days since her sickness, she said to her old husband, "When I die, you might bury me in a large box." She didn't really want to be buried underground, you see. "Do not burn my body." She didn't want to be burnt. "Just put my horn spoon in my coffin and my marten's garment and also my fish knife." She needed a garment so she wouldn't be cold. Yeah. And what do you think she wanted the horn spoon for and the knife? Well, we'll see. After a short time, she pretended to die. Then all the chief's tribe gathered and cried for her. So the people make a large box to bury her. They put her into it with 2 marten blankets and 1 sea otter garment, also many dozen goodly horn spoon with fish knife, and they put it on the tree at the little island at the front of the village. Now she pretended to be dead. After 2 nights that the chief went over the little island and sat right under the coffin into which the chieftainess was lying, his weeping. Then, while he was there, he beheld grubs falling down from the chieftainess's coffin. Then the chief thought, "She's full of grubs," so he made him wept bitterly. Well, you know where the grubs came from. The chieftainess actually scraping the spoon horn with her fish knife into the coffin, so the scraping the horn spoon looked just like as maggots. This again would be a traditional bit. And since the chieftainess was in her coffin, that the young man went into her every night in her coffin, while the village people was all slept. He went over the little island, and he climbed on the tree and kicked the cover of the coffin, saying, "Let me into you, ghost." Then the chieftainess was laughing in her coffin bed. Ha 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 ha. On your behalf, I pretended to make grubs myself. So she opened her coffin cover, and the man went in and lay down with her. The young man always went up to her every night, but the great chief did not know it. He's still weeping. No one could comfort him. And then one night, some other young people went over that little island where the chieftainess laid. It was apparently a place where he went. They soon sat with his sweetheart under the chieftainess's coffin. They behold a young man coming over to where they was. They knew it was the chief's nephew. He climbed up to where the chieftainess's coffin. He kicked the coffin cover. He says, "Let me in, you ghost." And they heard the chieftainess laugh in her coffin. They heard her reply, "Ha, ha, ha, I pretended to make maggots of myself on your behalf." They saw the young man went into her coffin, and this young couple heard what was played in the coffin. Then before the daylight, the nephew of the chief come out from the coffin. Then they told the chief. Mm-hmm. So the chief sent over two attendants to keep watch there, and he commanded them, if it is sure, throw down the coffin. Destroy them, in other words. Therefore, these two attendants went over. They watched the coffin, and while the village people sleep, they behold a man coming over. They knew it was the chief's nephew. He climbed up the tree to where the chieftainess laid. As soon as he reached the top of the coffin, he kicked the coffin cover, saying, "Let me into you, ghost." I mean, he has to repeat this three times. They heard the chieftainess laughing. She replied, "Ha, ha, ha, I pretended to make maggots out of your behalf." These attendants heard what was played in the coffin, and at midnight they heard there was ceased. These attendants knew they were slept, therefore they climbed on the tree and they threw down the large coffin. The chieftainess was bursted, and the chief nephew also was killed. And when these men came down, they saw a baby boy who was among the intestines of his mother. They went into the chief's house. They told him it was true. They told him also that the child was alive. Then the chief ordered them to bring the child to him, so they brought the child to him. It sucked the intestines of its mother, therefore the child's name was Sucking Intestines. So far in the story, it is a traditional story with the Shimshon, which, of course, I believe, came into the Shimshon rather late through the French fur traders. At least scholars have said that, but that's to one side. Except Tate, some Shimshon had tacked it onto the raven story, so that it's the beginning of the raven, and this child is the raven. Mm-hmm. He goes on to do all the raven adventures. Tate said, "No, it's not a raven story. It's a separate story." But the only way that he had it was as attached to the raven story. At least that's what we have up to this point in the story. He's taking it from the Nass River tale, which he had. At this point, he's left on his own. He has to write. He has to finish a story. He doesn't have a model for this. He's sitting in his room. If he was to follow his source, he would have this young man go on to be Raven. And since he doesn't believe that it's Raven, and knows it is a separate story in his own mind, and yet doesn't know how it ends, he has to end it. And this is, I believe, Henry Tate, the creative writer. So let's see how he ends it. The child grew up in the chief's house, and the chief loved the little boy most. And when the boy was able to walk, he went over often to that little island to get spruce chewing gum, for he likes chewing gum best at the same spruce where his mother's coffin was, while she pretended to make maggots out of herself. And the chief took him over and burnt some pitch with fire to let the child chewing. This is if you knew the habits of the Shimshin, you probably know that this was, I mean, I don't know, but I'm presuming from this story that they would burn the resin to make it chewable, and they'd have to use fire to do that. With some of his slaves, they did it so many times. The boy walked over alone to that island sometimes to get gum from the same spruce as his mother's grave. His mind was set on the little island to where he was born. In other words, he gets a fixation. He played around the island almost every day, so the slaves took him over there. He became a beautiful young boy. Now the chief loved him more every day. Therefore, on the next day that the young boy said to his father, the chief, "Let us go over to that little island and burn off the pitch with fire." So the chief went with him and some of his slaves. Then the chief ordered his male slave to burn off the pitch. So they did. They burnt pitch. Then the chief sat near the spruce with the boy stood in front of him. "Then," says Tate, "the flame of the fire, like a tongue, took the boy from the chief's bosom, and the boy was burnt to dead. And the chief was mourned again, for the fire swallowed up the boy."
This is tragic.
Well, I would say, well, it's sad because, I mean, obviously, the chief loses something he's learned to love. But to me, to what I get out of this is the use of a symbolism, that the guilt is passed on from the mother to the boy, who can't escape the scene of the crime, has to go back to it. And the kind of irony that it's chewing gum that he's after, which is sweet, but it turns violent, turns sour. And so you have a tragic ending. But it's one that seems to me to not be in a tradition, but came out of the creative fund of Tate's own mind. But how did these stories get written in the first place? How did they get told in the first place? They got told by people who were storytellers who had this ability, just as Tate had. And I don't think, you see, I mean, there is some collectors of stories would want to throw this out because it's too original. It's not traditional. I appreciate it because it is original.
Ralph Maud, thank you very much for introducing us to these stories. If you want to find more, once again, this story and the first read, both from The Porcupine Hunter and Other Stories, it was published in 1993 by Talon Books. Talon Books is located in Vancouver, yes? All right. Seek it out through your local bookstore. I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations. Dr. Ralph Maud has been our guest. It's been a lovely hour. Thanks. Thanks.
Yeah.
And I hope you join us again next week. Thanks a lot. Good fun.
But no longer does this generation have that luxury.
This is KUAC FM in Fairbanks. You're listening to Conversations, a special 90-minute Conversations on your public radio station for Alaska's interior today. I'm Susan McGinnis. I'm going to step aside just one moment to announce that this is the final day of Festival 93. There are folks out in our hallway waiting for you to call at 474-1993 or 1-800-478-7491 if you support this kind of programming by listening to it weekly. And if you want to support it with a contribution to public broadcasting, do so by calling 474-1993. Folks will be glad to hear from you. And if you're out and about today, stop by Bentley Mall, the North Pole Mall, if you're in North Pole, or Fred Meyer's West. All places have tables with our volunteers. And while you're there, say thanks to our volunteers. Now, we'd like to continue with this special 90-minute Conversations. If you're an opera fan, the opera will be Wagner's Das Rheingold today, and it airs at 1:30. We'll continue this conversation with Donald Novak. Don, thanks for coming back into the studio today. We'll add two more voices in our studio here at KUAC, and your thoughts when you're ready to call. We'd like to invite you to join in, talk to us about sexuality in the 90s, sexuality at the end of the 20th century, about thinking and behavior in the time of AIDS, about your kids, if you were parents or grandparents, about yourselves. This is a kind of an anonymous phone line, if you'd like, today. So, my guests, Donald Novak, Dale Fodness, and Melinda Evans. They were the three principal researchers in a Center for Health and Counseling survey of UAF students conducted in 1992. Donald Novak, assistant professor of speech communication at UAF. Dale Fodness, associate professor of business with a specialty in marketing. And Dr. Melinda Evans, campus physician at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. You know, when we were just kind of emerging from that last segment of the interview, Donald, you were mentioning that, once again, the chasm between knowledge and behavior. And I know there were some people sitting out in the audience saying, those kids just have to get it together. If they would just straighten up and fly right, pull up their socks, be sensible. And I found myself thinking, when I was listening to this, that it took me 34 years to stop smoking. Even though I went to sleep every night thinking, oh, Susan, you're killing yourself. That I know people with anorexia nervosa should know better. It's not a matter of knowing better. From nail biting to battering, there are people out in the world who know what they're doing and don't change their behavior. So let me throw that out to you so you can take a look at it. Melinda, Dale, Donald, any one of three? Is it the same thing the kids are experiencing when I lie in bed at night and think, boy, I gotta quit smoking? Melinda?
Well, I think there's a couple of issues. One is that when you're young, you don't think it's ever going to happen to you. So whether it's smoking-related cancer or problems or sexually transmitted disease and unplanned pregnancy, HIV infection, you simply don't think it's going to happen to you. It happens to somebody else. So there's that issue of immortality. Sometimes it's related to self-esteem. If you don't truly love yourself, then maybe you're not worth saving, whether it's wearing your seatbelt, not drinking when driving, quitting smoking, or being as safe as you can sexually. And self-esteem certainly is an issue that gets a lot of press and importance from grade school on up. There's some really excellent programs for our kids in the schools in Fairbanks North Star Borough, but it's even important at the college level that people deal with underlying issues that are important to them, whether it's childhood sexual abuse, sexual assault, living in a household with alcoholic parents, whatever it is, that they deal with those issues and move on to being the kind of person that they want to be and taking care of themselves.
No easy thing to do.
No, it's not an easy thing to do. If this were easy, we would have some really good solutions in this country, and we don't. It's a very difficult area.
Yeah, if I could follow up on that from a behavioral scientist point of view, we have a real hard time with understanding the black box that's within all of us. We can understand many of the inputs, for example, the information that we can take in. And then many times we see that the outputs, what actually is processed and results in behavior, is very different than what people are taking in.